So welcome to the UCL Science Policy podcast series. I'm joined today by Dame Anne Johnson, who is a Professor of Infectious Disease Epidemiology and Chair of the Grand Challenge for Global Health at University College London. You are involved in a number of high-profile policy debates, I guess most prominently the debate about sex in Britain in particular. And you are a medic by background, and I'm interested to know if that sort of changes how you get involved in them, coming from a clinical rather than just a researcher background. And then you got involved in epidemiology, particularly around the HIV AIDS epidemic.
That's right.
And can you tell us a little bit, so that was one of these incidents where a new disease arrives and causes not just a huge amount of scientific panic, the panic to understand what's going on, but also a degree of moral panic as well. I mean, how was it trying to navigate those two things at once?
Well, you're absolutely right about the moral panic and the public health panic. It was interesting in those early days seeing that most of the scientific focus was absolutely on what's the cause of this, who's going to get the virus first, can we get a vaccine, will there be a cure? If you go back to the papers in those days, there are great promises of a vaccine within a few years. But were very few people who were really concerned with the public health issues. I travelled to San Francisco in 1986, right at the beginning of the at the height, really, of the HIV epidemic. It was absolutely apparent there was hidden transmission rates before anyone knew the virus was around, and the same thing was happening in London. But we were fortunate in being a couple of years behind, and we got all the incredible work of the gay communities in San Francisco and the States who had worked to raise awareness in the gay community and change sexual behaviour, kind of reached London at an earlier stage in the epidemic. And that was hugely influential and combined, I think, with the political atmosphere in which both the chief medical officer of the time, Donald Acheson, Sir Donald Acheson, and the Secretary of State of Health, Norman Fowler, really worked incredibly hard together to get the public information campaigns out. And they were criticised at the time for being too scary. The reality is those campaigns saved us from a much bigger epidemic in hindsight.
But attracted quite a lot of moral criticism at the time, didn't they? Drawing attention to something that was seen as rather distasteful.
Well, I think at that time there was so much greater stigma about gay sex, and a lot of it was just not known about. One forgets that the legislation around that legalised homosexuality, it was only in the late 60s. This was only, 15 years later. It was a very different environment. There was huge fear of casual transmission and huge fear of large-scale heterosexual transmission. And one of the iconic moments for me was that at UCL, one of my first jobs was to design a ward for people who were dying of AIDS, something which, you know, within 20 years later, we've just forgotten about. It was opened by Princess Diana, and she shook hands on camera with an AIDS patient. If you look at that photograph, it's an iconic image. The AIDS patient has his back to the camera because people couldn't identify themselves. But that photograph did an extraordinary amount to allay fear and actually stigma worldwide.
And now you're leading the charge, if you like, to reveal the reality of our sexual practices and the public health risks and benefits that might come from our varied sex lives. And last week, this is we're talking today a week after the release of the latest round of this, the National Survey of Sexual Attitudes and Lifestyles, NatSal. From your story, we've come a long way in being able to deal with the realities of that, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's extraordinary. The first survey was actually banned from public funding by Margaret Thatcher, very famously, and really we could only really justify it on the basis of trying to understand how HIV might be transmitted. And we were absolutely clear that was the entire justification. And it's now 21 years, so we say NatSal's come of age, since we did the first feasibility studies. And it's incredible how our thinking's changed, and there's much more public discourse. in this last survey, I think we've not only are we now studying a wider range of sexually transmitted infections and all the usual things, but we've also this time for the first time looked at non-volitional sex or sex against one's will, which we wouldn't have asked about 20 years ago. And we've also asked about the relation between people's general health and their sexual lifestyles. And I think the media has been really interesting because it's easy to see us as very sort of sexualized, whatever that word means, or sexually liberal. But actually, the reality of people's lives is so different from what's on the media. And I think there's just, in a way, we'll see what happens now, that there is a kind of new debate about what all this stuff means in our lives when we're not thinking of it purely as some idealized form of life that we see in various forms of the media.
Mm. And you saw with the coverage, didn't you, that there was this sort of initial desperation by newspapers and websites and all the rest to find the line, whether it's entertainment or a moralistic line, to take through these things. But actually, there was so much in the data that actually there were sort of layers beneath it that revealed all sorts of nuances about the reality of our sex lives.
Yes, and I've been very interested in something will always get picked up and made a story of, but I think what's interested me are the features papers after the original first data come out, people writing much more thoughtful pieces about are we having less sex, that was one of the discussions, and being much more sort of open about the fact that people aren't always having very frequent sex lives, that sex changes through our lives, that it matters to us in different ways, but also that our attitudes are changing. So we're much more accepting now, much, much more accepting of gay relationships than we were 20 years ago. But we're less accepting of non-exclusivity in marriage. I think this is a really interesting thing to think about from an ethical point of view. In the last 6 months, there's been a huge amount of discussion about sexual abuse, which was going on in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and which was clearly just swept under the carpet. So I just wonder whether we're beginning to have a more sensible discussion and even rethinking the ethics of sex, about the sex we have, which is good for us, if you like, which is part of our relationships, something we enjoy. Most of us wouldn't have been here without it.
Mm.
Against a sex that does, where we do one another harm.
So there's a really interesting there's an interesting story behind this, which is about that, you know, the assumption is that maybe we're a bit uncomfortable sort of knowing, we don't want it all exposed, you know, it's secret and it's private, but actually once it is revealed, it can sort of be empowering, that actually the reality of our sex lives is rather different from the portrayal in the media, and that certain things are not getting worse, but they're still causes for concern in public health terms or in terms of safety. And there's something very interesting about just making that visible, isn't there, as a researcher?
Yes, I think it is interesting. There's you said on one hand it is something you find very difficult to talk about. On the other hand, maybe there's a kind of collective sigh of relief when if you read teen survey, you know, magazine surveys, you'd think that all the teenagers are having sex all the time. Our data show that it's about 30%. It's still quite a high proportion, but nevertheless, it's only 30% who are having sex before 16. We also, in that sense, we are kind of trying to show people how people's lives vary very much, and the most important thing is to kind of enable lives that are satisfying, that are consensual, where people are making choices within them, rather than on some kind of idealised and unrealistic view.
Mm. I mean, there's a huge amount in there that would seem to be immediately applicable to our personal lives in terms of how we think and what we do, and I mean, in my case and in lots of other people, what sorts of things we tell our children, you know, in the case of how many people are having teenage sex and all the rest of it. What do we tell policymakers about it? What can they do about it? And how frustrating is it getting that message across?
Well, I haven't found it frustrating getting our message across to policymakers, because actually NatSal was always planned to provide data for policy. That was absolutely at the heart of it from the beginning. At the beginning, it was always designed to work out how far HIV might spread. It's been used for 20 years now to estimate the extent of HIV in the population and the amount of it that's underdiagnosed and so on. It's been used, the data have been used for the debates around age of consent of homosexuality in Parliament. It's been used for sex education services. It's been used to plan the HPV vaccination programme, the chlamydia screening programme. So it's always been used for policy. That's actually the message, of course, that gets lost in the papers. And I hope this will be true this time round too. So the message for us, for policymakers, I think, is first of all, there's lots of ways in which we're doing well with some of the STI services, but we need to think about that as we go into new areas of commissioning. But there are all these other areas, like people being able to report sexual violence, which doesn't happen, and we need to do something about. And then the fact that people's general health affects their sex lives in ways that we still find very difficult to talk about in clinical practice. Mm.
And does it help reframing the issue as one of public health? Does that make for an easier discussion with politicians and policymakers rather than treating it as, I don't know, any other sort of domestic policy issue?
Oh, I think it's really important that it's seen as a health issue. And that's been true from the beginning. And actually, when we did have a sexual health strategy at the beginning of the last decade, the data were really important for that. So I'd like to think that the survey has tried to help us develop a language around sex, and to be able to have more of a debate about some of these issues, but a debate that's evidence-based rather than based on what people may or may not think does or doesn't go on.
Terrific. Dame Anne Johnson, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.